Good evening and welcome to everyone. Although I'm sure people will continue trickling in for a while, in deference to those who did appear on time, I think we should get going. It's a great pleasure this evening to welcome Bob Michael, who is for the next 8 or 9 months a visiting centennial professor at the school, based in the Population Studies Group, but visiting centennial professors are meant to be wide-ranging people who have connections with many departments in the school. Bob, I think, as you'll see in a moment, fits that brief really rather well. His normal affiliation is with the University of Chicago. He began life doing a PhD in economics. Life begins with a PhD, you'll note. At Columbia in 1969. And as you'll all be aware, anyone who does a PhD in economics, it's a religion for life, and whatever else they might get into, it taints all their future work, or supports or improves all their future work, he might prefer me to say. He then had a long affiliation with the National Bureau of Economic Research, academic posts at UCLA and Stanford, and became a full professor of economics at Stanford in the very late 1970s, and in 1980 moved to the University of Chicago. Like many fairly successful academics, that heralded the beginning of an administrative career rather than the flourishing and continuation of a research career. He became founding director of the Population Research Center at Chicago in the early 80s, In 1984, he then became the director of NORC, the National Opinion Research Center, as it used to be called. And then following on that, became the founding dean of the Harris Graduate School of Public Policy from 1989 to 94. How, you might ask, has he had time to do any research? Well, I think that's a fair question, given all those duties. But he has remained extremely active in his chosen areas of research. And these, over the years, have spanned issues like the economics of education, a large range of things in the area I might call economic demography, dealing with the family, cohabitation, divorce, living alone, topics like that. He's also continued a strong interest in issues of income distribution, and particularly the allocation of income within the household, and more recently, a strong interest in child development issues over and above the topic we're about to hear about tonight, adult sexual behavior in the US. You might ask, how is it that an economist comes to study sexual behavior? I'll leave it to Bob to explain the answer to you.
Thank you, John. Let me say, to begin, what a pleasure it is to be with you here at the London School of Economics. I am enjoying myself immensely, and it is a particular honor to be here during your centennial year. And I want to express how very much I appreciate the wonderful hospitality that my host, John Hopcraft, and all those in the Population Studies Group have extended to me. It's a real joy to be here. The university officials set the date for this lecture before they knew my topic, I believe. Yet, what better way to celebrate Valentine's Day than a lecture on sexual behavior? Well, all right, there is a better way. But from what I've heard about Valentine's Day in centuries past in your country, there's no way an academic lecture on sex can match the excitement of those moral holidays. But perhaps they, too, were more mythical than real, or perhaps that's what passes for progress these days in the world. Now we attend lectures. John raised the issue of why an economist might be involved in the study of sexual behavior. Well, economics is the study of choices, limited resources used to satisfy many competing ends, and there are surely many choices and much limitation in our resources as we express our sexuality. I will suggest in a few minutes that there also is a great deal of strategy that is evident in our sexual behavior. So economics is, I believe, a natural perspective from which to study sexual behavior. In fact, given my interests in economic demography and survey research, as well as social policy, I can't think of many other areas of human behavior that are a better combination of my interests. However, I got into the study of sexual behavior, like so many others, because of AIDS. In the mid-1980s, I was director of a demography center at the University of Chicago, and at a meeting of the center directors at the National Institutes of Health in Washington, the branch chief, Wendy Baldwin, told us that NIH would be mounting a major effort to encourage social scientists to become active in research on AIDS. She put it this way: social science claims to have insights about why people behave the way they do, and at this time it's essential that we have a better understanding about sexual behavior. The reason was that then, in 1986, it was known that AIDS was caused by a retrovirus. It was known to be transmitted by sexual behavior and by needle sharing. But it was also becoming clear that the basic science of retrovirology was not adequately advanced to lead quickly to a cure or a preventative for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. In fact, Baldwin told us demographers, it might be into the next decade, meaning the 1990s, before medical science had an effective means of preventing the spread of this virus. But since its spread was directly controlled by changes in behavior, the social sciences, she insisted, have an exceptional opportunity to use their insights about behavior to identify the groups most at risk, to determine the prevalence of the behaviors that are implicated in the spread of HIV, and to document the changes in sexual behavior that cause AIDS. In short, if we could help understand that behavior, social science could improve public health policy and perhaps could help save lives. Now, that's the sort of challenge any self-respecting researcher has to consider very seriously. Prompted by that challenge from NIH, I formed a collaboration in the following months with my University of Chicago colleague, Ed Laumann. Ed is a sociologist who studies network theory. That complements my research as an economist who studies choices people make about family structure, marriage, divorce, cohabitation, and the like. I was also at the time, as John mentioned, head of NORC, one of the nation's best survey research houses, and it was clear that any project on sexual behavior would of necessity begin by collecting data. Now, neither Ed nor I had ever or previously done any research on sexual behavior, so we sought someone with some research expertise in that area. Thus, we were joined by John Gagnon, another sociologist who teaches at State University of New York in Stony Brook, who happened to have been trained at U of C, the University of Chicago. Gagnon is one of the few academic social scientists who spent most of his research career studying sexual behavior. So when NIH competed two contracts in 1987 to design and craft survey research on sexual behavior as related to AIDS, our University of Chicago team, working through NORC, won the contract to study adults, while another team at the University of North Carolina won the contract to study adolescents. The most urgent need was accurate and reliable data on sexual behavior, for none then existed. That was the overwhelming consensus expressed by a panel from the National Academy of Sciences and by the public health community. There was no baseline information about sexual practices in our nation. Nowhere to look to find, for example, what proportion of men in their 20s had more than 10 sex partners in the last year, or what percent of married men and women had intercourse with someone outside their marriage that might therefore be at risk of contracting and spreading a disease like HIV. Or what percent of all couples engaged in a practice like anal intercourse that was known to be particularly high risk for HIV transmission. It had been policy in the United States not to know these things. It had been policy not to look at these intimate details, not to ask these questions on any competent survey. That policy was not benign. The medical profession discovered that when they needed the information as a basis for the decisions they had to make related to HIV. That was why the public health profession was caught so flat-footed by the HIV epidemic. There was not adequate baseline information on which to formulate effective public health policy. That state of affairs is well illustrated by the only item on AIDS available in the HMSO, the government bookshop up here on High Holborn, which I went into a couple of weeks ago. That was one book there titled Sexual Behavior and AIDS in Great Britain. But it makes projections of AIDS cases out to the year 2018. That book was published in 1993, just about 18 months ago. And it says at one point, quote, on some points related to sexual behavior, we had almost no data at all. And on others, we had to extrapolate gleanings from the Kinsey report on sexual behavior, whose results were separated from the current requirements in the UK by a distance of an ocean, a gap of 50 years, and a social sexual revolution. That, in a government publication in your country, 18 months ago. Surprisingly, experience with HIV in the 1980s was not adequate to fully discredit and discard that policy of imposed ignorance about sexual behavior. My team found that out when we prepared to conduct a 2,000-person pretest of the questionnaire on adult sexual behavior near the end of 1988. Despite the urgent callings for the information that we were setting out to get, and despite the fact that the federal government's public health agencies, NIH, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and the National Academy of Sciences had asked for the data and had funded it, the Reagan administration, and subsequently the Bush administration, prevented our survey from being done. Our project became so hotly debated in Congress and in the press that the law authorizing the very existence of NIH for the current 5 years has within it a clause specifically stating that NIH shall not make use, shall not make any funds available for the SHARP study. That's our survey. It was euphemistically called the Survey of Health and AIDS-Related Practices, SHARP. The name itself is another indication of the ambivalence and caution with which my government approached the scientific study of sexual behavior. Our efforts over the subsequent 3 years went into polishing our survey questionnaire while congressional permission to conduct the survey was withheld. We failed to persuade Congress to let us do it, suggesting perhaps that what Ed and I needed was not another sociologist, but a political scientist. Clearly, Ed and John and I were no match for the professional politicians in mounting support and winning a vote on the floor of Congress. Fortunately, once it was clear in 1991 that our request of October 1988 was flatly denied, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation provided us support to undertake a smaller survey, and by the time we got in the field with our questionnaire, several other American foundations had provided additional support so we could have an expanded sample size. The MacArthur Foundation, the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, the New York Community Trust, AMFAR, the American Foundation for AIDS Research, and the Ford Foundation all contributed. Those eight American foundations made it possible for us to field in 1992 the survey we'd planned 4 years before. It's that survey of 3,432 adults age 18 to 59 that were the basis of the two books that were recently published. Those of you familiar with the British experience in conducting a survey of sexual behavior will be struck by the similarities in the States and here in Britain. Government requests in 1987 in both nations led to prompt and competent responses by research or by the research community. Here, led by Kay Wellings, Julia Field, Anne M. Johnson, and Jane Wadsworth, working through SCPR, a survey research firm here in London that I think of as sort of the NORC of Great Britain. Then after letting the contract and having a successful feasibility study here in Britain in May of 1988, just as we were preparing our questionnaire to submit to our government for clearance, your government began to drag its feet about doing the survey for about a year until your Sunday Times in September of 1989 trumpeted on page one, quote, Thatcher halts survey of sex. The only difference was it took our government an extra 2 years to say no, and the private charities are correctly reluctant to step forward while the government is still considering funding such a project. Here, the Wellcome Trust stepped forward within about a month, and the British survey was fielded from May 1990 through November of 1991. Ours, again, was longer being rejected by the government and subsequently funded by foundations, so our field period began just a few months after the British study came out of the field. In its science, our survey is not exceptional. It was a standard, high-quality scientific effort. But the application of the usual scientific sampling to research on sexual behavior was very unusual. We did a 90-minute face-to-face interview with a scientifically drawn sample of adults. We selected our sample, like almost all good samples, from a household sampling frame based on the most recent decennial census of the population. We randomly sampled by a stratified, clustered design that gave us addresses across the United States, and from each of which one English-speaking adult, age 18 to 59, was again randomly selected as the respondent. We did go to great lengths to protect the confidentiality of the respondent. For example, we shredded all the identifying information so the records couldn't be subpoenaed for use in court cases to establish that an illegal sex act had been committed or that a marital infidelity had been admitted to. We motivated the respondents with the public health officials' need to know about AIDS, and we returned to the reluctant respondents again and again to seek his or her cooperation. I did a lot of phoning from Chicago that winter and spring, for example. We gave special training to the interviewers to create an atmosphere of privacy, professionalism, and non-judgmental fact-finding. It had been an article of faith in the U.S. since at least the publication of Kenzie's work in the late 40s that Americans would not cooperate in a scientifically sampled survey of sex. While it was true there had never been one succeeded, there had also never been one that failed, because there had never been anyone who tried. In that context, it was risky, a risky undertaking for the foundations that gave us about $2 million to do our study, just as it was for the Wellcome Trust to do so here in Great Britain. In the context of that uncertainty about its feasibility, it's worth considerable emphasis that our survey achieved a response rate that was even higher than the target that we'd set. In fact, a remarkably high 79% of those randomly selected adults were willing to sit with our interviewer and answer our extensive 90-minute survey about sexual practices and history, fantasies, preferences, and opinions. 4 out of 5 randomly selected respondents cooperated. We'd set what we considered an optimistic target of 75% based on high-quality surveys done at NORC and elsewhere in the U.S., I think no other fact in our survey speaks more eloquently to the basic sexual health of our nation than that, despite the furor in the press and in Congress, nearly 80%, 4 out of 5 men and women that we randomly selected, were willing to cooperate with the survey. Our questionnaire had an eye on the issues of importance to public health officials concerned with AIDS. We also had an eye on the wider issue of the social context in which our sex lives are led, the motivations and meanings, as well as the details about the sex practices. Most prior research on sexual behavior had been clinic-based, not survey-based. It was either biomedical, reproductive biology, or clinical medicine like the famous Masters and Johnson's work of the 60s, or it was clinical psychology following Freud and Ellis and others. The well-known exception in the U.S. was Kenzie, whose pioneering study had then begun in the late 30s and extended into the 50s, his orientation was essentially taxonomic, as Kenzie, himself a biologist, had previously been a taxonomer of gall wasps. And he made categories out of behavior and counted how many people fit into each category, which surely was interesting, instructive, and influential. However, his sampling was wholly flawed, unfortunately, since he asserted that a scientifically drawn sample just would not cooperate. He may have been correct for his time and location in Indiana in the 1930s and 40s, but he never tried. Consequently, his results were then and are now of very little scientific use. His was a convenient sample of volunteers, and such a sample was then and is now known to be biased within magnitudes that aren't known and therefore can't be corrected. His assertion that a properly drawn scientific sample would not cooperate in a sexual behavior survey became, unfortunately, one of his most enduring legacies. We went into the field on Valentine's Day, just exactly 3 years ago today. We were in the field until early September, Labor Day, in fact. We thought it seemed appropriate to go in on Valentine's Day and come out on Labor Day. I'll not rehearse with you the evidence on the matter, but will assert that the quality of the data is extremely high. While one can't prove the accuracy of responses, we have subjected our data to external validation where that's possible, in the demographic information, for example, and to known period effects, like the legalization of abortion in 1973 in the states, and to severe internal checks using redundant questions asked both in the face-to-face interview and in the private self-administered questionnaire that the interviewer never read, and in checks against other high-quality data of recent vintage both in the states and elsewhere. In all those tests, the data appear to be of exceptionally high quality. This assertion was confirmed with the evaluation of the professional interviewers who considered the respondents well-motivated to tell the truth, intensely engaged in the interviewer content, often finding the discussion self-revealing and even cathartic. As one who has collected data on a number of other studies and used them in the past, I believe these data are of as high quality as any with which I've ever worked. Now, rather than attempt to summarize a large number of specific findings about sexual practices, let me characterize a few broad findings and then illustrate even a fewer of those in some detail, and then talk about some implications of those facts and what they might mean. First, broad finding. The sexual behavior of most adults in the United States is remarkably conventional. A vast majority of U.S. population age 18 to 59 has one sex partner within a year. They have sex not all that frequently, averaging less than twice a week, and for not all that long a duration when they do have sex. A large majority of Americans do not find very many sex practices all that very appealing, and they don't engage in a rather limited repertoire of sexual activities. And yet, despite the relative sedentary nature of their sex lives, these same men and women report themselves to be reasonably happy with their sex lives and with their lovers. Let me show you a few details about some of that. We have the number of sex partners in the past 12 months. And about 12% of Americans report having no sex partner in the last year. Over 70% report having one. About 14% report having two to four. And only 3% of Americans report having had five or more sex partners in the last 12 months. Remember, these are adults age 18 to 59. That 3% represents about 4 million Americans. Of those, about 3 million are men, 1 million women. Well over 2 million of those are in the age range 18 to 24. Nearly all of them are in the non-married category. I'm going to go through several slides rather quickly and then talk about them. This is the same information, but over the lifetime or the adult lifetime, not just the last year. About 3% of Americans report never having had a sex partner, virgins. About a quarter of Americans report having had but one sex partner ever in their life up to this point, 30% having two to four, 22% with five to 10, 11% 11 to 20, and about 9% having 21 or more partners over their lifetime. And that 9% represents about 13 million Americans, 11 million of whom are men. Let's talk about the frequency of sex for a moment. This is the distribution for men and women, and the first point is simply how similar the distributions are. The black are the bar graphs for men, the gray for women, and they're quite similar here in terms of reports. Something less than 10% of Americans report having sex four or more times a week. The mode and the median here is a few times a month, and with a finer calibration, that comes down to about six times a month. Not wild sex there. Show you the same information for women only, and this time broken down by age. The black graphs here are the young women, age 18 to 24. Those 30 to 39 and those 50 to 59 are the gray on this end. One sees among those having sex four or more times a week that very few of the older folks do so, relatively more of the young folks do so. But again, distributions that tend to center on a few times a year, and especially for women, older women, some 30% reporting no sex within the last year. Now, the duration of the last sex event, and by this term, last sex event, we mean, and we had well specified, that this is the last time you had sex. It might have been last night, last weekend, last summer, a long time ago, but we talked about that particular event, thinking it quite salient in one's mind. We didn't ask for too fine a grained calibration here, and the bulk of Americans report having had sex that lasted between 15 minutes and an hour. About 70% of Americans fall in that category, with some saying it lasted more than an hour, and another group saying it lasted less than 15 minutes. You'll notice this happens to be only for women only, that it is the younger people that say they spent relatively more time having sex than the older folks, and conversely, the older folks who say they spent relatively little time having sex than the younger. We think there may be some difference in definitions of what the sex event time contains and when you start counting, if you are married, for example, than if you're non-cohabiting. And these married folks have sex more frequently, but substantially shorter duration than the non-married that have longer term and less frequent sex. A busy chart here, and I'll put this back up in a minute and leave it. We ask about sexual practices in which one finds appealing. And among both the young and the old, the men and the women, the only activity that was clearly very appealing to most all was vaginal intercourse. It's the only one that has more than half the sample thinking it's a very appealing activity. Watching your partner undress, 18 to 50% of these four categories thought that appealing. Receiving and giving oral sex, 30, 11, 16 in that range. The Christian ethic or the Christian perspective that it is more blessed to give than to receive does not seem to be borne out by the perceptions of appeal with respect to giving and getting oral sex. Group sex is not very appealing. Using a dildo or a vibrator, watching others have sex, 2%, 6%, 2%, 4%. Same gender sex, low rates. Sex with a stranger, and either forcing someone to have sex or being forced to have sex, almost none of the sample found either of those activities very appealing. I'll put that back in a minute. That's kind of particularly interesting, I think. In terms of behavior as distinct from appeal, this table shows you for men and for women, ever in their lifetime, that about 77, 79% of men say they have had oral sex, and about 27, 28% did so the very last time they had sex. For women, 68, 73% had ever experienced oral sex, 19, 20% said they did it last time they had sex. Anal intercourse, 26% of men said they had ever done so, 2% the last time. 20% of women said they had done so, 1% the last time. And finally, in this set of figures, measures of sexual satisfaction. This has always had orgasm in vaginal intercourse. Over 70% of men say they do, less than 30% of women say they do. We ask a series of questions about how physically pleased and satisfied you were with your lover and how emotionally satisfied you were with your lover. In the context of one particular partner, the most recent or the primary partner, and if one had several, about several
at least two separately. So these are pieces of information about that particular lover. And some 40% of both the men and the women report very high rates of emotional satisfaction and physical pleasure from that partner. And these are the extremely satisfied. If one adds the quite satisfied or the very satisfied as well, you get up to about 80%. So these Americans are quite satisfied with their lover. Now let me talk about that a little bit. I'll put this one back up there just for a while. I've suggested that sex lives of American adults are conventional, and if you find that surprising and are inclined to doubt the accuracy of this pattern in broad terms, ask yourself this: on what basis have you formed your perceptions about the sexual behavior in your population or ours or mine? It surely is not informed by any routine publication of government statistics on the matter. The recent issue of your Central Statistical Office's Social Trends, for example, implies there is sex by telling you about activities like cohabitation and fertility and contraception, visits to sexually transmitted disease clinics, talks about abortion, talks about teenage conceptions, but there's not one graph or table about anything sexual behavior in there. You can find out about leisure, find out about library books, you can find out about sea travel, no sex. And that's the same in our statistical abstract in the United States. And likewise in non-governmental surveys as well. Until the last 4 or 5 years, there simply has not been solid evidence on which to form perceptions. So you formed your perceptions from two sources, no doubt. One is your own social network of friends, family, and acquaintances, and the other, surely, is the media, TV, newspaper and magazines, the movie, the theaters. I'll not belabor the point, but just suggest that if those are your sources, you're not on firm ground. After all, those sources themselves have no basis in fact from which to draw conclusions, and for rather different reasons, neither your family and friends nor the entertainment media is particularly intent on providing you accurate information on the subject anyway. Those of you who heard the Lionel Robbins lectures in this room a couple of weeks ago will recall Lester Thoreau commenting that on television the only folks who work are the cops, and that if we estimate the level of income in America from TV shows, Thoreau guessed that that level depicted there was about 4 times the actual average level in the country. So we'd be sorely misinformed about work habits or income levels in the United States if we formed our impressions solely from TV. Now I ask you, in the matter of sexual behavior, do you suppose TV's distortion is less or greater than that in depicting income levels? Greater, surely, since all those folks in the sitcoms who don't work have to have something to do. But the important difference between our perceptions about sex and our perceptions about income distribution, as obtained on TV, is this. In the case of income, we also have accurate information from reputable surveys done within the government and outside. Thus, we can know the facts about it, as the important Joseph Rowntree Foundation's Inquiry on Income and Wealth, that was reported last Friday in the papers, illustrates so very well. So on this and most topics used on television and in movies for entertainment purposes, at least subconsciously we understand that what we're seeing is fantasy, and it's not reality. But in the domain of sexual behavior, we have no such counterbalancing weight of evidence to offset the fantasy. So the vacuum created by the absence of real information is filled by the fantasy from TV, movies, and fiction. We have had, in fact, very little ground on which to form a reliable impression about the sex lives of our populations. That was the conclusion reached by the public health community in your country and mine about a decade ago. That's one of the unfortunate consequences of the social policy of promoting ignorance about sexual behavior. We don't know what reality is, and we're consequently susceptible to being told all manner of falsehoods. That's surely a situation ripe for misuse through intimidation, exploitation, and harassment, and can fuel the natural anxiety about so intimate and vulnerable an act as sex. Let's focus for a moment on a couple of the findings I just showed you. Take for the fact that in the most recent sexual event, about a quarter of women and men said they'd engaged in oral sex. That may sound low to you, but recall, as this graph that's still up there shows, that 37% of the men said they found it very appealing to give oral sex, and 33% of the women said they found it very appealing to get oral sex. So what's the probability a randomly paired couple will find it, that they both find this particular activity very appealing? Well, it's 37% of 33%. That's 12%. So that one quarter who report engaging in that particular activity the last time they had sex may not be so low. In fact, in two-thirds of the couples, if randomly paired, they'll find that they have different preferences about oral sex, and these differences will need to be worked out or negotiated or settled in some way. Now, of course, the pairings may not be random. As I'll show you in a minute, they certainly are not. But they're also not likely to be sorted out explicitly on preferences for specific sex practices. That's just not the social scripting in our societies. A second point about these findings. It may seem trite or simplistic that since such a large portion of Americans report they're happy with their sex lives and their lovers, but we also ask a series of questions about seven specific sexual dysfunctions and found that somewhat more than half the women, 54%, and nearly half the men, 44%, reported at least one of these problems within the last year. The question specifically asked was this: during the last 12 months, has there ever been a period of several months or more when you lacked interest in having sex, or were unable to come to climax, or came to a climax too quickly, or experienced physical pain during intercourse, or did not find sex pleasurable, or felt anxious just before having sex about your ability to perform sexually, or for men, had trouble achieving or maintaining an erection, or for women, had trouble lubricating? Now, individually, the incidence of these problems ranged from about 5% to 35%, and overall, as I say, about half the sample reported at least one of these problems. So respondents were not reluctant to admit the unpleasant aspects of their sex experiences. They were not Pollyannas about it. Yet they assessed their sex lives overall as really pretty good. That is a more realistic and, I think, fundamentally healthy perception about sex than we might have expected. It goes along with the 79% response rate, I think, in suggesting that Americans are less hung up about sex and less unrealistic about it than are their political leaders or those in the media and entertainment industries. One might suggest that this is a pretty sophisticated view of one's sex life. There are problems. It doesn't mirror the fantasy life of the entertainment world, but it is, on balance, pretty good. Now, before turning to a second set of findings, I want to note that the British study reported, to my mind, remarkably similar findings regarding the number of partners in the last year or over the last 5 years, or the numbers of partners over the lifetime. It also found similar distributions for frequency of sex and its decline with age and its higher frequency in marriage and cohabitation, and relatively similar findings on lifetime and recent practices of oral sex and on recent practices of anal sex. That study did not look into the psychological and pleasurable nature of sexual relations, so I can't compare on those evaluations or on the social context of sex, to which I now turn. The second general theme that I want to stress is this. There's compelling evidence in this study that our sex lives are deeply socially embedded. We meet our sex partners through our friendship networks, not surprisingly, and most of us are in fact introduced to our lover by someone who knows both of us. As a result, a very large percent of couples are of the same race ethnicity, the same education level, the same age level, and the same religion. Let's look at a couple of facts on that. These four pie charts represent couples that are currently married, couples that are currently cohabiting, couples that are long-term lovers, more than a month but not living together, and couples that are very short-term, might be as much as just one sexual event. All I want you to see here is this, that in each of those cases, at least half of the couples were introduced by either mutual friends or family. Okay? Here you have 35% and 15%, and only 32% were self-identified or self introduced of those that married. About 36% were self-introduced of those that were cohabitations. And even among those that were very short-term sex partnerships, less than half were self-introduced, and the rest were, again, introduced by someone who knew the two partners. Socially embedded selection of our sex partners. Here, let's talk about those who are married. Of all the married pairs in our sample, 93% were of the same race ethnicity. 93%. 78% were of the same age within a 5-year age interval. 82% of all those married couples were of the same education level or one-off, and that's less than high school, some college, or voc ed, college, or postgraduate. Yeah. And 72% were of the same religion, broadly defined, and conservative, Christian, Protestant, or liberal Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Eastern, none. That's something that anyone in the Pop Studies program could have told you, that married couples are very much alike. Given the areas of interest of your Pop Studies program, they could have also told you that that's also true of those who cohabit, that cohabiting partners are very much alike, 80% of the same ethnicity and the like. But what is quite remarkable is that even in these very short-term partnerships, there's substantial similarity. 91% of those less than a month-long partnerships were of the same race ethnicity. 87% of those short-term partnerships were from the same or one-off education. Okay? We have sex with people very much like ourselves, even in the short-run sexual activities, not simply in our formal marriages. To understand why this strong social sorting by social characteristics is functional, think of the delicacy of the sexual encounter itself. The communication is of necessity subtle, with nuances that matter greatly. So the more shared is the prior experience, the less awkward and the more effective those sexual cues and communications might be. In exposing ourselves in a most intimate and vulnerable way in sexual exchange, it's reasonable and somewhat self-protective to select as a mate one with whom you share much, since that's more likely to result in an effective communication and a positive outcome. This social embeddedness of our sex lives has important implications. It means that our social networks can be effective in encouraging us to select certain types of partners and engage in certain types of sex and to avoid others. Seldom, incidentally, are those social pressures closely linked to what we might consider the potential raw sexual satisfaction of the partner or practice. No, it has to do with the behavior that promotes cohesion within the network, not the joys of sex that our friends and families encourage us. We're expected to bring our lover to meet and share outings with our friends, and they, like our lover's friends, help evaluate the new prospective couple, encouraging some and discouraging others, typically protecting the cohesion of the group. That romantic notion that you might see a stranger across a crowded room and fall in love at first sight has a subtext. Subtext is that typically that crowded room is in a school or in a private party attended by others who are demographically and socially much like yourself. So the stranger is already selected in large measure to be someone about your age, about your education, and so on. This social embeddedness also requires us to face certain trade-offs and make certain choices in our sex lives. We can't have both socially approved monogamous marital sex and a wild, free-spirited, multi-partnered sexual exploration on the side. We must choose. Most of us are immersed in social networks for most of our lives that strongly encourage the one and discourage the other of those two behaviors. Our sexual choices become one with our economic and social choices about living arrangements, cohabiting or marrying, about parenting, even about careers and location. It is choices about sex are not disassociated, disembodied, hedonistic, and sensuous affairs of the fantasy world. No, they're linked, they're rather tightly linked by our social embeddedness to the other domains of our lives. It helps define what we consider pleasurable and satisfying sexually, and maybe why monogamously married respondents in our study consistently rate their sex partner higher than did all the others. The secondary partners were rated far behind in terms of producing feelings of being loved, wanted, cared for sexually, even thrilled, and just the reverse for negative feelings like fear and guilt and anxiety and sadness. Let me take this observation one step further. The social embeddedness that occurs in our sex lives, when accompanied by little or no factual information about sexual behavior generally, and only the most scripted and stylized forms of social debate about sexual issues, means there's considerable isolation and segmentation about sexual attitudes. This leads to rigidity of views and perceptions, to strongly held opinions reinforced by our social peers, seldom confronted by the range of views represented by other groups. Since sex is not a topic in which there's a natural or easy dialogue, and in which the social policy has typically been to encourage not talking about it or looking into it in a factual way, the social discussions we have about most other subjects just don't take place about sex. That's why I think we find in our survey such deeply held and remarkably diverse views about pornography, abortion, nudity, extramarital sex, homosexuality, and on and on and on. We find that about 30% of those we surveyed fall into a category we described as reproductive or traditional in their views about sex, that sex is appropriate only in a formal marriage, that homosexuality is always wrong, abortion always wrong, and many other opinions are categorical and expressed as always wrong. Another quarter of those surveyed held what we call a recreational view. If it feels good and it hurts no one, then it's a good thing. Incidentally, a larger portion of those in the recreational category are men. About 33% of men are in that category, only 19% of women. Portend of problems. And the other 45% or so of the population at large fall in what we call a relational view of sex, that sex should be accompanied by affection and love, but not necessarily formal marriage, that there are fewer categorical or always wrong behaviors, but restraint and balance is called for. These three categories, the reproductionists on the one end, the relationalists in the center, and the recreationalists on the other end, all seem to hold their views very deeply. They generally see them as conforming to their religion or their ethical tenets. They're often also held by their peers and social networks. And these opinions are rather strikingly consistent with their own sexual behavior, as it had been reported to us earlier in the survey, incidentally. Consequently, these opinions are not easily swayed. They're largely a part of a person's self-identity. This helps us understand how difficult it may be to reach consensus about the policy issues that surround sex, issues of abortion, for example, or issues of homosexuality. It also further persuades me of the importance that we study the topic, that we know the range of behavior and judgments, that we engage in the dialogue among social groups and between lovers, for that matter, that can enhance our capacity to understand and thus to respect these diverse views, and where a consensus or common practice is required to reach some tolerable understanding. On the brighter side, all this segmentation of our sex lives makes it much less likely that a sexually transmitted infection that is inefficiently transmitted, as is HIV, will become widespread in a society that behaves as ours does. Now let me turn to the several points about sexually transmitted diseases, since that was such a key motivation for our study. My third point about our study, general finding, is a very high prevalence of sexual transmitted infection in the United States, very high prevalence. And there's strong evidence of what the risk factors are for STDs, and there's strong evidence as well of behavioral responses to the risks of AIDS. One in every six men and women in our survey reported having had sometime in their life a sexually transmitted infection, 16% of the men, 18% of the women. And the evidence of risk is compelling, both the direct and the indirect evidence. Indirectly, those with more partners are exposed to many more attributes of partners that reflect risk, and directly, those with more partners are dramatically more likely to have had a bacterial or an incurable viral infection like herpes, hepatitis B, genital warts, HIV. but the evidence of behavioral response to the risk of the new deadly disease, HIV infection, is also compelling. Let's again look at a few numbers here. These are lifetime rates of sexually transmitted infections. By gender, the black bars are the men, the gray bars are the women. Gonorrhea, about 9% of men and 4.5% of the women report having had gonorrhea sometime in their life. Looking at the other bacterial infections, non-gonococcal urethritis, male disease, about 2%. Chlamydia, a disease only relatively recently identified and diagnosed, so somewhat difficult to get out of a sample of this size over a lifetime, since it's so much a recent disease, at least in its diagnosis. Here we have about 4.5% of women with that disease and 2% of men. Syphilis, about 1%, and pelvic inflammatory disease, a disease of women, again, about 2.5%. And the incurable diseases, the genital warts, human papillomavirus, 6% of the women reporting having that disease, 3% of the men. Hepatitis B, 1% or so. Genital herpes, about 3% of the women, and a few cases of AIDS. We incidentally had about six cases of AIDS in our sample, 3 men, 3 women. All 3 men were bisexual. 3 of the 6 reported more than 100 partners. One of the other women was a needle-sharing IV drug user. Overall, 16% of the men having had one of these diseases, 18% of the women. For most of these diseases, you see higher rates for the women than the men, as might be expected from the rates of transmission to and from men and women. In terms of these unfamiliarity attributes, we identified several. List 4 or 5 of them. Having a new partner within the last year, having a one-time partner, okay, having had sex with that person only once within the year. Short time, had sex with them less than 2 months. A pickup or a casual partner, someone that was described as being that. Or someone you knew 2 days or less before you first had sex with them. Taking those 4 or 5 characteristics, this table does this. Takes all those with one sex partner and arrays those respondents with one sex partner in the last year by how many of those risky attributes they were exposed to. And 90% of those with one sex partner in the last year were exposed to none of those 5 or 6 attributes of risk. Of those with one sex partner, about, 6%, were exposed to one of those attributes, like a new partner, okay, and on down. So the black distribution you see is very dominated over here with no risky attributes, and those are the folks with one sex partner. Go to the other extreme, those with 3 or more sex partners, and you find that, 38% of those with 3 sex partners were exposed to at least 4 of those attributes of riskiness. And another 30-some percent were exposed to 3 of those attributes of riskiness. So 70% of those with 3 partners were exposed to a considerable amount of riskiness in terms of the unfamiliarity with which they had, with which they knew the partner that they had sex with. Now, to show you that that matters, these are the rates of sexually transmitted infection or sexually transmitted disease in the last year by whether the individual had a new partner within the year. Of those that had a new partner within the year, all combined, 4% had an STD that year or an infection, STI, that year. Of those that did not have a new partner this past year, only 1% had an STI that year. Now, some of these can be holdover viral infections that don't go away, or it could be they had some other risk factor. Of those that had any one-time partner, spelled whichever way you like here, if those that did have a one-time partner, 5.6% had an STI in the last year. Of those that did not have a one-time partner, 1%. Substantial evidence here of much higher risk and much more disease among those that had a new partner, had a one-time partner, had a casual or pickup partner, and likewise for the other attributes. Translating that into then the risk of disease by the number of partners, this I think may be my most important slide. Those that had one partner in the last year, those that had one partner in a lifetime, have very low rates of ever having had a sexually transmitted infection. Of those with 2 to 4 partners in a lifetime, somewhat more, but less than 10% having ever had a sexually transmitted infection. As the number of partners rises from 5 to 10, 11 to 20, 21 or more, the percent of these men in the gray and these women in the black columns that have had a disease rises dramatically, up to, for these women that have had 20 or more partners, well over 50% of them report having had a sexually transmitted infection sometime in their life. That increase for the women and that similar increase for the men is quite compelling, I think. You notice that there are, in each instance, there's more disease among the women with that number of partners than men, and yet overall, I told you, there are the same, roughly the same rates of STI for the men and the women. You think about why or how that can be, since the one is simply a weighted average of the little white columns and the other a weighted average of the black ones. Turning to prevention of disease, the percent using condom in the last event, that is the last time you had sex, was a condom used. Overall, about 13%. Of those that had one partner, about 11%. Of those that had 2 partners, 20% used a condom the last time. This is 2 partners in the year, not necessarily the second partner, but the last time that man or woman had sex who had 2 partners in the year, 20% used a condom. Of those that had 3 partners in the last year, pretty systematically, 32% used a condom in the last event. Those that had 4 partners, over 40% used a condom. Of those that had 5 or more partners, instead of this number being up there the way a public health official would like to see it, it's back down to about 30%. But remember that 71% of the population's in this column, another 10% off there to the left with no sex partner, about 14% are in this group. There are only 3% of Americans in this category. But they are those with substantial risk, and they are not responding appropriately in terms of risk reduction. Go one step further on that same point. This narrows not condom use in the last event, but condom use in the last year, whether you always used condoms. Those that had but one partner, 11% used condoms regularly. Of those that had 2 partners, 15% used condoms with that primary partner. And of those with 3 partners, 20% used condoms always with that primary partner. So you see 11, 15, 20, an increase in condom use with increased risk. And even more so when you go to the secondary partner, 37% used condoms compared to 15 for those with only 2 with 2 partners in the year. 40% used condoms always with their secondary partner of those that had 3 or more. Substantial response to the risk here. Now a final couple of tables on one point, and that is having either changed behavior because of AIDS or been tested because of, or for HIV. Let's take the changed behavior, the gray lines. Those that had no partners in the last year, 30% of whom said they had changed their behavior because of the risks of AIDS. That's quite consistent. They may have changed their behavior by now not having any partners. Those with one partner, 20% of them said they had changed their behavior. Those with 2 to 4 partners last year, where are we? About 70% of them said they had changed their behavior because of AIDS. And of those with 5 or more partners, 76% said they had changed their behavior because of AIDS. Substantial evidence here of a change in behavior in reaction, okay, to the risk of AIDS. Likewise, and ever having been tested for AIDS, that rises as well, somewhat less dramatically, with the number of sex partners in the last year. And to show you that same information broken down by age instead, this 18 to 24-year-olds, this 55 to 59-year-olds, it is among the younger men and women who have changed their behavior most and who have ever been tested for AIDS. Let me talk about that a few minutes. We've seen that as the number of sex partners increases, so does the likelihood that at least one of those partners is a one-time sex partner or a one-night stand, or with someone the respondent knew for only a few hours or less than 2 days. So in terms of sexual exclusivity, we find that 96% of those with one sex partner say that one sex partner was exclusive with them, 96%. But of those with two partners, only 33% said those two partners were exclusive with them. And of those with two partners, something like 25% said that those two partners had at least three other partners. Of those with three partners, even fewer said all three of them were exclusive with them, and many more of them said that, of course, those three partners had many more sex partners. That is, the total number of people with whom one is exposed to disease in a year does not increase additively from one to two to three to four, as one's own partners increase in that manner. Rather, the total exposure is more like a geometric series than an arithmetic one, rising from 1 to 4 to 9 to 16 or something like that. Those who have sex with many have sex with people who have sex with many other people. So the exposure to risk is dramatic and is confirmed, sadly, by the nearly geometric increase in the lifetime prevalence of the disease by the number of lifetime partners, and likewise by the incidence of disease in the past year by the number of partners in the last year. But there is some good news in the finding I just showed you. We saw that as the number of partners rises, so does the likelihood of a condom being used. There's much purposive behavior here. This is also evidence. There's also evidence of this small group of a core 3% who don't seem to be behaving in this way, where so much risk, in fact, lies. Those who had a new partner within the last year are three times as likely to use a condom than those who did not. Those with a one-time partner are more than twice as likely to use a condom, and on through every little nuance and perturbation we could find here to look at. Where the risk is greater, the effect, the efforts to protect against the risk is also greater. And knowledge about the effective means of preventing sexually transmitted infection by abstinence, monogamy, and condom use is very high in the U.S. Similarly, when we ask about the risk of AIDS specifically, 27% of the people said they'd changed their behavior because of HIV, and 27% had been tested, and 30% changed their behavior. So again, as we saw, those most at risk had the biggest changes. This kind of fits with the economic sense of a rational actor and some purpose of behavior, which to an economist is quite reassuring. One other point about AIDS. We conclude from four facts, three of which come directly from our research, that it's not likely that there will ever be, or that there will not, that there will now be, a major epidemic of AIDS in the general population of the U.S. Okay, we just don't think it likely there will be a general epidemic. The one fact that comes exclusively from other research is that the likelihood of contracting HIV for a woman, say, who has unprotected vaginal intercourse with an infectious man is 1 in 500. The risk is higher from anal intercourse and lower from a woman to a man, but unlike a pregnancy where both are fertile, the risk of from one act of unprotected intercourse is about 2%, 1 in 50, that you'll get pregnant. Or unlike the risk of gonorrhea, where if he's infectious, the risk from one act of unprotected intercourse is 50%, 1 in 2 that you'll get gonorrhea. It's 1 in 500 of HIV. Now, one time will do it, and the devastation is terrible. So this isn't a fact that should lower one's resolve, but from a public health perspective, this is, fortunately, an inefficiently transmitted infection in a healthy population like the U.S. Combine that fact with three others found in our data. First, over 80% of Americans have one or no sex partner. Second, we overwhelmingly have sex with partners like ourselves, and social characteristics And so effectively have segmented the population. And in those segments in which HIV is not now prevalent, it's not likely to become so. And third, we've seen a rather impressive extent of behavior change as reported by respondents, particularly those high at risk. In combination, these four facts imply, I think, that there is not a high likelihood of a major outbreak of AIDS in the U.S. population. Now, I hasten to add, these conditions may not hold in other societies or at other times. And the assessment should not in any way diminish one's commitment to research on AIDS, or one's compassion for those with AIDS, or one's own diligence and resolve to lower the risk in every instance. It does suggest that targeting educational effects where the pockets of risk are great makes more sense. We knew before how much about the characteristics of the high-risk groups. But what we did not know was how low the risks were in some of these other groups. So it would not have been prudent, I think, to have targeted efforts as tightly as now I think it best for policy to do. The British sex survey showed certain important similarities with ours in regard to sexually transmitted infections and a few differences. The rates of STDs in Britain are only about half that in the US, but the behavioral responses seem to be quite similar. So in the British data as well as ours, there's substantial evidence of purposive response to that risk. And that's, I think, quite enough statistics for the hour. I won't subject you to information about the rates of masturbation or forced sex or the disquieting gender differences that are out there, but I do want to make 2 points in closing. First, as our study in the British survey, I think, convincingly demonstrated, we can obtain information about sexual behavior through national surveys that are accurate, revealing, and useful. Surveys of sex can be done while fully respecting the rights of privacy of respondents, and adults will, in the proper context, with the proper safeguards, cooperate on such a survey, and so it's possible to study sex in the same way we do everything else. Second, although sex is indeed intimate and very private and should be protected from inappropriate public exposure, sexual behavior and attitudes have profound public consequences. Those are as direct as the transmission of disease and as indirect as sexual harassment and intimidation. In the jargon of economics, there are important externalities from sexual behavior, where one person or couple's behavior has an effect on others is through the transmission of disease or the social costs of an unwanted birth. And there are important public goods aspects to that behavior. Like it or not, on certain matters, we must share a common behavior in a particular community. That community must have a decision about, say, the legality of abortion or the legality of anal intercourse, or in the limits, if any, on the rights extended to gays in that community. Since we must make a collective decision about certain sexual matters, we need to know more about sexual behavior than we have in the past been able to know. That knowledge will surely not resolve the public debates, but the public policy will be better policy if it's informed by accurate information. So not only can we know about sexual behavior, we have a right to know about it, and we have a need to know, both in formulating public policy and in formulating our own private choices about our own sexual lifestyles. Thank you, and happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Bob. In keeping with LSE traditions, Bob has kindly agreed to answer at least a couple of questions. I won't want to keep you away from the drinks, which will be available in the Vera Anstey room up half a floor, saving huge climbs. But there's one up there, I think.
You said 20% didn't respond. Did you get any reasons why they didn't respond? Do you think they would have been more active or less active than the people responding?
That's a great question, a key issue on any of these surveys. That's true in other surveys as well. I mentioned that we'd taken a target of 75% because that's a high and very good response rate on a study typically. You just don't know about the folks that don't. We know they weren't unusual in terms of their age, their marital status, their education level, or any of the other items that we know what should have been the result, because we got, in fact, the distributions of the group we looked at that were exactly like the U.S. population from the census. So we know they aren't biased in those ways. There's no way to know whether they had more or less sex than those that didn't answer. But that's much less likely to be a problem with 79% response than, oh, some of these surveys that you've been reading about for years in the paper, from the Red Book survey to the Playboy survey to the Height Report, where you're talking about often less than 10% responding. The other thing is, we had some evidence from one of our studies earlier that those that didn't respond were, if anything, a little older and just not inclined to respond rather than in any way sexually different than those that did respond. I like to say the main reason we had a cutoff age at 59 is John Gagnon was 57 at the time we made it. But in fact, the more serious reason, I think, was that we had a limited amount of money, especially as we were designing the survey. We wanted to know as much as we could about those most at risk of AIDS. And we knew from prior studies that those over the age of 50 or those over the age of 60 or those over the age of 70 were less sexually active, less at risk. And so in order to have a larger sample in the age groups of relevance to that topic, we decided to have some cutoff and arbitrarily chose 59. We had another study that in which we had no upper bound and went on up. The highest, the oldest in that sample was 81. And the behavior there, of course, trails off. But it was more just that practical issue.
As a citizen of the United States, I'm curious if you have an opinion as to why a popularly elected president like Reagan, a popularly elected president like Bush, and popularly elected congressmen are so opposed to sexual research and sexual study when
Well, I don't think it has much to do with the sexual diseases being on the increase. I think it has a lot to do with anxiety about sex, their own and ours collectively. It is a product of not ever having an opportunity to talk about it, look at it, treat it as we treat most every other issue. It is not a more hotly contested issue than income distribution and what our tax rates should be and where we ought to be in that regard. But we're over that hurdle on income. We know how many people are poor, how many are very wealthy. On this topic, there's a great anxiety, and I think the conservative politicians that did not want the study done were fearful that a study would reveal that too many people are doing too many awful things, and that would encourage even more to do so. It's fear. Okay?
Last one up.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure where you went with that.
You had quite a number of breakdowns. I'm wondering if there were others.
Yeah, the book, of course, lays it out in a lot more detail. We, as social scientists, expected to see very strong relationships anticipated seeing strong relationships by, social variables like education, race, ethnicity, religion, income, but we didn't. The dominant social characteristics that overwhelmingly dominate these data in terms of distinguishing are gender, age, and marital status. And only one of those three is discretionary, marital status. Okay. Religion just does not have a big bite in the United States in terms of distinguishing people by how often they do it, what they do, what they like, or anything else. Likewise, education does not do a great deal. I'm overstating it a bit, but they are a quarter the size of the differentiation by age, by gender, and by marital status. Once you're married, you behave very differently than when you're not. If you are divorced and no longer married, you again behave very much like a non-married person. Okay, that's the one discretionary factor that seems to really dominate. Is that responsive to the kind of issue you're dealing with? Yes, and in fact, the data are available in the public domain for scientific purposes at this point.
It only remains for me, I think, on behalf of everyone present, to thank Bob for a stimulating lecture. He's indeed, I think, indicated to us how sex and the social sciences fit rather well together. We've touched on politics of funding, issues in the behavioral sciences, issues about relationships to social structure, touched on rational choice theory, and strayed into areas of public policy and public health. I mean, a pretty good tour. It only remains to trail his next set piece talk during the centenary celebrations of LSE. He's one of his other duties is as chairman of the National Academy of Sciences panel on poverty and family assistance, and the report from that is due on May the 6th. It's a bit like the Roundtree Income and Wealth Inquiry, but not quite. And he's giving a talk during the centenary celebrations at LSE on, I think it's wealth, class, and poverty. I forget the precise title. The only other thing is to comment on how pleasurable it is to see current American sex researcher who has a less exotic name than is often the case. We've come across Shia Hight recently in a public lecture at the LSE. There's another American sex researcher called Pepper Schwartz. I think Robert Michael is a much more boring name. There are drinks being served in the Vera Anstey room, which, as I say, is half a floor up. And thank you once again, Bob.